This is the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm Howard Jacobson of PlantYourself.com. Before we get to today's interview, quick announcement. The Big Change Program will open up next week. So watch your inbox if you get my email newsletter. If not, you should get my email newsletter. You can get it at PlantYourself.com. All right, today's guest is Bradley Stolberg, a writer for New York Magazine and Outside Magazine, and he writes about the connections between exercise and human physiology and psychology, and about human peak performance. He's interviewed many of the world's elite athletes, and he has synthesized their insights into valuable lessons for the rest of us. So I first came across his work in this article that I just found so beautiful. Beautifully researched, beautifully written, beautifully conceived. It's called How Exercise Shapes You Far Beyond the Gym. I want to read the first paragraph for you. Bradley writes, "When I first started training for marathons a little over 10 years ago, my coach told me something I've never forgotten, that I would need to learn how to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. I didn't know it at the time, but that skill cultivated through running would help me as much, if not more, off the road as it would on it." So, if you've been listening to the podcast and you've been hearing snippets of my own story, you'll know that that's kind of my theme of this year, learning how to get comfortable with discomfort. From my interview with Mark Schoen, author of Your Survival Instinct is Killing You, to my work with Glenn Murphy, my martial arts instructor, who finally got me to pour a 5-gallon bucket of freezing cold water over my head every morning, to my work with Josh Lajani, turning me into an ultra runner, eager to embrace the kind of non-destructive pain that is going to make me grittier and is going to make me perform better in the long run. So I reached out to Brad to learn more about him, about his research, and as soon as we started talking, I realized I'd found a kindred spirit. So I hope you have as much fun listening to our conversation as I had participating in it. So without further ado, Bradley Stolberg, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Howard.
Yeah, so you came to my attention because of an article that I have probably shared with as many people as anything I've ever shared. Which is, it was in New York Magazine, and the title is How Exercise Shapes You Far Beyond the Gym. And I shared it with people largely to just like have them understand me. You know, because it's so clearly written and well referenced and comprehensive, and I see you've done a lot of writing for Outside Magazine. You write about physical fitness, and you have a lot of personal experience as well as research and interviews. And so I wanted to kind of explore what you have discovered about like how physical activity has maybe less than obvious positive impacts upon our life.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite topics to think about in research. So I'm looking forward to having this conversation.
Well, so,
you know, I think it starts with this notion of learning how to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. And I think that it's in the piece that I wrote for New York Magazine. It's one of the governing thoughts, is that physical fitness is really a good venue to practice being uncomfortable. And in modern society that's so built around being comfortable, there aren't too many venues to do that.
Yeah. And that was really what got me. And it's been a long time, you know, just me personally, that's been an insight that I have to admit I was about 50 years old before I grasped. So I'm curious, like, just, you know, before we get into the details of that, like, do you mind sharing like your story about, you know, being an athlete and competing or just, you know, recreationally, and where and when you first encountered that notion of using activity to be comfortable with discomfort?
Yeah, so I grew up playing sports. I always loved sports. I played high school football and basketball, and was a decent high school football player, but never really good enough to play at a big school in college. So when I went to college, I was at a little bit of a loss. I was always the first guy in and the last guy out of the weight room in high school, but it was always to serve an end, which was to be a better football player. It's not like I ever was lifting weights for vanity. So I kind of struggled. I had no fitness goals. I was a little bit aimless. And I ended up losing a bet to a friend. I know it sounds kind of cliche, but it's a true story. And as the result of my loss, I had to go on a 5-mile run with him. And I'd be lying if I said it was like love at first sight and I fell in love with running, but I didn't hate it. So at that point during undergraduate school, probably right around when I was 19 years old, I started to get pretty into running and hooked on running and endurance sports. I'm 30 right now. So since then, over the last 10 years, my main fitness practice has been more in the realm of endurance sports. And I think that's where I learned this notion, or at least experienced the benefit far beyond the physical, benefits of fitness.
Mm. Now, so you were the first one in the weight room and the last one out. Now, I haven't spent a lot of time in weight rooms actually since high school, but I do remember how unpleasant it was. And I was just doing it for girls, you know, honestly, I wasn't,
yeah.
I wasn't playing anything in particular. But what was the difference?
I'll tell you what, at that age, doing it for girls might be more of a motivating factor than for football. Hard to say.
Yeah. But you know, if you get knocked over by an offensive tackle, like you can pin that more clearly to your fitness than like getting rejected from the Valentine's dance. It wasn't like,
totally.
If only I'd done another set.
No, I'm just giving you a hard time. I agree.
So when you started running, like that first run, were you, I imagine your friend who won the bet was, in better shape for running. Like, were you just trying to keep up?
Yeah, I think I was just trying to keep up. I mean, we're young, we're like 19 years old. I think he was just looking for someone to run with, at school. And so he probably tempered the pace for me looking back on it. I'm sure he could have run me into the ground if he wanted to. So yeah, I was just trying to get through it. I mean, the only running I had ever done was for punishment, right? In football, if you have to run around the left field, if you do something wrong, you break a rule. So it's pretty wild that now I voluntarily will go out and run as long as possible.
So what was the difference for you when you started getting into endurance between that kind of sort of self, not punishment, but you know, that kind of discomfort versus the discomfort of the weight room or the football scrimmage?
You know, so I think that it probably has less to do with the change in sport and just more to do with like maturity and growing up and a changing mindset. I'm sure that if I were to go back and get on a hard weight training program right now, I'd reap many of the same benefits the same psychological benefits, obviously very different physiological benefits, but the same psychological benefits that I do from running. So I think it probably has more with just becoming more introspective than the actual sport itself. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is, like I said earlier, when I was playing football, everything was a means to an end, and the end was winning football games. Whereas when I started running, sure, I was goal-oriented. At first, I wanted to do a 10K, then a half marathon, then marathons, then get my time lower. But it's not like I was getting paid to do it. I wasn't on a team. I was really just competing with myself. So I think that I was more open to being able to draw benefits just from the joy and participation in running versus running for some other end, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's something that I've discovered because, you know, I've run on and off for a long time, but only recently did I like enter a race. And it's really interesting to me to see the interplay between doing it for its own sake and also having a competition. It's definitely partly means to an end, but at the same time, it's totally for its own sake.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, like I said, I think it was probably more of a change of mindset. But what I noticed, so when I graduated, this gets back a little bit to my story. When I graduated from school, I went to work for a pretty fast-paced corporate consulting firm. you know, what many would call a fairly high stress job. And on days that I had done a hard run, or just when I was in the middle of training hard, it seemed like I was more calm and less fazed by things that were fazing my peers at work. And it's almost, you know, looking back, what I'd say is after you've done a hard interval workout in the morning, very, very few things are going to be as uncomfortable as that you're going to confront throughout the rest of the day.
So you had, and you had a kind of an objective hard day. Like, you know, like one of the things I want to talk about is this article you just wrote about, you know, the Zen of running. And you quote this philosopher who talks about sort of contrived metrics, right? Mm-hmm. So like, and especially at a consulting company, like to some extent, it's all contrived metrics, like how well you're doing. Right. Was that part of it that, you know,
You hit the nail on the head, Howard. I mean, absolutely. That's when I, you know, that article I recently wrote on Zen and the Art of Running was based on journals that I had written when I was at the consulting firm. And it's at that time that I really fell in love with running. And I think you're 100% right, because in consulting, everything is contrived, and whether or not you do a good, you know, quote unquote, good job, based on so many factors that are so subjective that you don't control. It's based on the politics at the consulting firm. It's based on the politics at the client organization, whether or not they adopt your recommendations. I mean, there are so many interim steps between the work that you do and the results that it's almost impossible to say that I had a direct impact, my work, my actions had a direct impact on the outcome. Whereas running is completely the opposite. It's just you. You know, some people run barefoot. I don't, but it's just you, a pair of shoes in the road, and you're competing against very, very objective metrics, right? There's time and there's distance, and neither of those things lie. There are very few things that get in between. Am I getting faster? Can I run farther? Which is so juxtaposed to the kind of good that I was experiencing in the corporate world.
Yeah, and I feel myself sometimes chafing against those objective metrics. Like I'm trying to play this mind game. Like, well, what about you know, elevation? Like trying to weasel out of putting in the effort that's going to get me the 52 minute 10K this morning or whatever.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, so. How did running then affect your sense of calm? Like, you know, it didn't add objective metrics to your consulting job, but what did it do for you at that place? How did it like change your thinking or your physiology or what?
Yeah. So I, you know, what I was experiencing back then, and at the time I didn't really have the science, until I researched for the New York Mag article. But like I said, I just felt like things that might have once fazed me ceased to faze me. And it comes back to that opening line that I said. I was learning how to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. At the time, I was trying to run fast and push myself. And running fast and pushing yourself is largely about just being able to sit with and be okay with not feeling great during a hard run. Obviously, you don't want to run yourself into the ground, overstress yourself, you'll get injured. But the process of training to run a fast marathon, at the end of the day, it's pretty hard. A lot of mornings are spent kind of grinding your teeth, getting through runs. And I'd finish a run and I'd get to work, and something came up at work that might be quite stressful to a lot of my colleagues and my peers. And I seemed to have a different reaction. And I noticed that other people that I worked with that were somewhat serious athletes, and this gets back to, you know, it's not just running. Some were cyclists. One guy was a power lifter. They just kind of shared that with me. It's like, okay, like this has come our way. We need to focus on what we can control. Keep our minds, you know, level-headed, stay calm, stay cool, stay collected, and not freak out. And I started to notice that it was a common theme that a lot of athletes were able to confront these challenges with a somewhat more stoic, level-headed demeanor than those that didn't participate in sports and in pushing their body. So at that point, I started to view running not only as this practice that gave me an objective good, which kind of fulfilled this need I felt that I had to strive for something that was all on me, but it also became a practice to cultivate a little bit more resistance to stress. And I want to be careful. I'm by no means bulletproof. You can ask my wife. I get stressed out about stupid stuff all the time, probably just a little bit less more than if I didn't run.
Right. Well, it's we who do it most need it most, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think there's a lot of truth to that.
So one thing I've heard about the consulting world, and this might date me a few years when I was sort of on the periphery of it around the year 2000. So it might have changed, but I doubt it, is that these top tier, high power corporate consulting firms look for really smart people who are insecure. So they can motivate them to, like, you know, 80 hour work weeks and constantly be trying to, like, improve the PowerPoint. So first of all, I'm wondering if that's, you know, just a silly stereotype, or if there's some truth to that in your experience.
I think it's hard to say. I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't want to paint that broad of a swath. I do think that, I mean, clearly they're going after smart people, because a lot of consulting is problem solving in strong communication. The insecurity thing is different. You know, I don't know. Like, I don't have any data or evidence to back that. Mm. But based on what I have researched and what I have learned about people that, you know, are willing to push and kind of become obsessed and workaholics, I think a lot of people do have some kind of void that they're trying to fill, or a little bit of an insecurity that they're kind of trying to prove to themselves and others that they can do it.
Yeah, and the reason I wanted to address that is because, you know, you mentioned, you know, just very sort of offhand, that when you're running and pushing yourself, you don't want to do it to the point of injury. And one of my big challenges has been to play with that edge, to learn the difference between pain and damage. And that's like a big theme in my, like, social interactions with people and work interactions, where, like, I would avoid conversations where I thought I was going to be criticized because it felt like it was going to be damaging as opposed to just uncomfortable and painful.
Yeah. It's such a wise insight, Howard. I totally agree with you. I think that, you know, physiologically, if you look at how a muscle grows, it grows after it is stressed and then allowed to recover. But if the muscle is stressed too much, i.e. you pick up way too heavy of a weight, or you go out and you run way too hard and way too long, you're going to injure the muscle, and that's bad. It's maladaptive. So you really need to dial in the right dose of stress and then make sure that you follow it with some rest and recovery. And while that's the key to physiological growth, I'm completely with you. I think that there's a lot of psychological growth, spiritual growth, cognitive growth that occurs in those same cycles. So you want to push yourself, you want to make yourself uncomfortable, but you can't cross the edge. And if you're constantly stressing yourself in an uncomfortable position, you're likely to burn out. Mm. And I think that's true of sport or anything else in life.
Yeah. So when did you start your freelance, or I don't know, your writing career?
Yeah, I started writing about 3.5 years ago. So I'd always loved writing. It's just that I was writing for an audience of one, which was myself, for for 7 years of my writing career. But over the last 3 years, I've become more serious about it, and now it's what I do professionally.
Uh huh. And were you interested at first in writing about, you know, sports and physical things, or like what was your the beat you thought you were going for?
Yeah, I think fitness and social science. And as you can see from some of my articles, like the one in New York Magazine, I really try to merge the two. I think that there's a lot of siloed thinking you know, so staying within a domain. So there's social scientists think about social science, and physiologists think about physiologists, and physicists think about physics. But I think that there's a lot of lessons and themes that kind of apply more broadly, and those are some of the themes that I'm most interested in learning about and covering.
Hmm. So what were some of the first things that you wanted to explore?
Yeah, so I, you know, beyond just this article, I'm really fascinated around the psychology and I guess you could almost call it the behavioral economics of fitness. So how things like willpower play out in a high-performance training environment. Things like the fresh start effect, which is this notion that you're more likely to start a diet or a new workout program or any kind of new goal on a Monday or the first of the month or the first of the quarter or the first of the year, because it psychologically kind of creates this clean slate. So I was curious to see if that could be harnessed for some kind of training effect. So I guess kind of like more creative slants on traditional health and fitness writing.
Hmm. Now, a lot of, I guess the people that you interview, I think of them as outliers, like, you know, Olympic marathoner, Des Linden or surfer Nick Lamb. Like, do you find that there are lessons from the outliers for the rest of us?
Yeah, I do. I actually have a book on that very topic coming out next year. So yeah, I think that there's, you know, it kind of comes back to, like I was saying, the different disciplines aren't siloed and you can start to see some themes. And when you talk to elite performers across different disciplines, there are absolutely a couple themes that emerge in how they approach their craft, even beyond sports. So across sports, a great surfer, a great mountaineer, a great runner, they end up doing many things quite similarly. But even like a great artist and a great mathematician, there are a few, more than a few common threads as to how they approach their work.
Ah, can you give us some previews before the book comes out?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one that we already touched on a little bit is this notion of working in cycles of stress and rest. And how that's really the key to growth, be it physical or mental or psychological, or if you want to call it spiritual, across the board. So I guess what I mean by this is most elite performers stay out of the gray area. So they're either working full tilt very, very intensely, or they are able to turn it off and shut it down and really rest and recover. And they're constantly repeating the cycle of working very, very hard and then resting and recovering and growing a little bit and then working a little bit harder, resting and recovering and growing more.
Gosh, I think, you know, one of the things I do have done and still do for a living is I coach like high performers in the corporate world. And if they heard you say that, they'd be quaking in their boots. Like they would have this fear of recovery And an even greater fear of being seen recovering, and you're saying like that's like the first thing you thought of in terms of like really elite performance.
Yeah, you know, 100% true. That they'd probably have that reaction, and it's so critical to elite performance. You know, when you get into the science too of like what happens when you sleep. That's when your brain consolidates memory, new neural connections are formed. Like you're not getting smarter or more advanced if you're an entrepreneur or a business person while you're staying awake grinding the midnight oil. You're often much, much, much better off to sleep and recover, because not only are you going to feel better and have more physiological energy, but your brain will actually function better. What I like to say is that the great athletes, elite performers have the courage to rest.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, it feels like courage, because resting, that sort of cycle and periodicity is really missing from our culture.
It is, and it takes courage. I mean, a great athlete could look and say, "Well, my peers are still training, right?" There, I forgot who said it or what the exact quote is, but there's that quote that if you're not working, someone else is. And I think that that applies to sport, that applies to the corporate world, it applies to school and students. But what I have realized based on my work interviewing elite performers and then in the research is that, yes, you need to work really, really hard, but you also need to recover. Because if you don't recover, you don't really ever get to work hard, and you kind of get stuck in this gray in-between zone where you're just constantly grinding, but it's not your best work because it can't be your best because you're not recovering.
Right. And then and it becomes a vicious cycle, right? Because then you see you're not performing, and so the only solution is to do more.
Bingo. In athletics, we call it overtraining. And it's basically, you know, overtraining is, you see that you're not performing, you do more, and you end up getting injured, hurt, and the kind of tail-end symptom of overtraining is burnout. And I think that applies 100% to the corporate world as well.
Hmm. That is such a rich topic. I can say I'm really looking forward to your book. What's another common thread that elite performers can teach the rest of us?
Yeah. So, another common thread is this notion of developing a purpose and or a sense of meaning behind your pursuit or behind the work that you do. Very, very, very rarely. I think I can only think of it on one occasion, and I'm not going to name him or her. Have I interviewed someone and said, like, I'm doing this because I want to be world champion because it will make me feel good.
Huh.
There's almost always some kind of greater cause or purpose linked to the pursuit of excellence. And there's a wide body of evidence showing that having that greater purpose does wonders for sustainable motivation. And there's even some newer research that shows that physiologically being invested in a purpose beyond yourself might actually help you get more out of your body.
Mm, so you're talking about, like, what are some examples of senses of meaning or purpose that have motivated people?
Yeah, so I think a common one is religion in athletes. You often hear an athlete will cross the finish line of a big race and say, you know, I was doing this for God. I have my God to thank. Family is another large purpose, right? You're doing this because my family gave so much for me, and this is how I provide for them. Outside of athletics, and a lot of artists will talk about just bringing joy to other people's life, and they make great work for other people to bring joy to their life. Sometimes you'll get someone that dedicates something to a family member that may have a disease or may have recently passed away. Lots of professors will figure out ways to tie their work to some sort of greater good. And I think it's having those kind of ties that are beyond oneself that can really work as fuel to motivate the pursuit of excellence.
Mm. Yeah. And it's, I guess, like, when you're doing it for yourself, or, you know, if you have some sort of concrete reason or goal, then that's kind of an upper limit, right? It sounds like what you're saying is that something where that is sort of infinite. Like, there's, you know, like, if I say, all right, I want to earn $100,000 this year, like, that might be a stretch goal, but it also could be like the upper limit. Whereas if I say I'm going to, you know, I want to grow my business to the point where I'm, you know, helping 50,000 people get healthy, and I'm going to, you know, set up a nonprofit, like, that kind of leaves it infinite.
Yeah, exactly. I think it sets a much higher, or as you point out, in some cases, an infinite boundary for what's possible. And I think that it helps to remove a lot of fear in getting back to insecurities and perhaps insecurities that we hold. Because if we're doing something purely for ourselves, it's very easy to get all wrapped up in ourselves and in our own ego.
Mm.
And there's all kinds of fear, right? I don't want to take a risk because if I fail, it's going to reflect negatively on me. Whereas if you're doing something for a greater cause, I think you're much more likely to almost transcend that notion of yourself and move beyond your fears and push the envelope a little bit more. There's some fascinating research that shows that when individuals meditate on their core values, so quite closely linked to a sense of purpose, they're much more likely to take on challenging causes and succeed.
Huh. That's good to know, because one of the things I do with some of my clients who are trying to improve their lives is I borrowed something from cognitive behavioral psychology, and I have people write out a note card with like all their transcendent reasons for wanting to lose weight, get healthy, and they read it every day, every morning, as kind of a lodestone, because then when they're at the luncheon and they get to make good or bad choices, they have their transcendent reasons still fresh in their minds.
Yeah, like you said, that's backed in so much science, which makes sense, right? I think that personally, I know that my core values help to ground me. But, you know, easy to say, hard to do, right? Like, actually, it's not too hard to do, but I often don't. Like, it would be wonderful if I started my day with a short reflection on my core values. It's something that I strive to do every day, but I don't do every day. But it's these little practices that I think can go a long way. They add up.
Yeah, right. Well, maybe if you spent a few minutes thinking about your core values, you would then spend some time thinking about your core values.
Right, exactly.
So catch 22 there. All right. How about one more common thread in high performers?
Yeah. They just don't care about the minutiae.
Huh.
So you've got, you know, in order to be really good at something, you need to obviously specialize, but it's not even about like only doing one thing at the expense of everything else. It's just not caring about small stuff that might otherwise detract from one's energy. And this kind of gets back to where we started, right? And like the kind of Zen in the art of running and being okay with being uncomfortable. But in all of my interviews, and especially when I get to spend time with some of these folks in person, they all just kind of have this demeanor where like, they're not concerned about how they look or about what they're going to wear that day. They're not concerned about, you know, like, where they might end up eating dinner. Some Olympic athletes actually are quite concerned about that, but that's for a whole different variety of reasons. But it's almost as if they're not wasting any energy on the minutia, so they can channel it all towards their pursuit.
Huh. That's really interesting.
And again, you know, and I could go on forever. I'm super interested in intellectually stimulated about these topics. That insight rests on a large body of research as well, that shows that we only have so much energy. Our willpower is this limited reservoir, and even things that seem trivial, like deciding what to wear, it taps into that willpower just a little bit. And if you have enough trivial things that you care about throughout the day, you know, maybe you lose 8 or 9% of your energy, and that can make a huge difference when you're really going for something.
Right. I think that's that ego depletion research.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. But it seems like
I'm not the first. I'm not the first person to bring this up. Right. There's that President Obama owns two suits, and like they're the same. He owns more than two suits, but only two styles, so he can reach into his closet and not have to think about what he wears. Albert Einstein was known for wearing the same thing every day. Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook. So others have pointed this out as a kind of an example, but I think that obviously extends well beyond what you're going to wear.
Yeah. And yeah, it's funny. I'm struggling with that this week. My wife's out of town. And so like, I have to decide like how much to shave and what parts of my face and whether I, you know, and like I look in the mirror and I'm getting like grosser and grosser. And like yesterday I decided, hey, let's try a goatee. And this morning my son looked at it and nearly puked. And so I just had a mustache, and then he refused to let me in his room. And it's like, yeah, it's so much easier when you decide once and you never have to decide again.
Yeah. Yep. And you know, there's a balance, because like the pursuit of excellence can also make someone pretty robotic. And I try to withhold values, right? Like winning an Olympic gold medal is so awesome, and you give up a lot to do it. So I think that, what I always tell people and what I tell myself is you have to find the right balance. And ultimately this gets to the last theme is really self-awareness. If I could say there's one thing to focus on. It's just being honestly, truly self-aware and being reflective about what your goals are, what you're doing to achieve them, what are the trade-offs, and just trying to bring that stuff into your awareness pretty frequently.
Yeah, that's the thing that I think running hard has taught me the most is like those conversations with myself about trade-offs are a really positive thing. It's almost like I used to think of them as like compromises or sacrifices, but now I think of it as like I have this full wallet and I'm at the toy store and I can't have everything, but I could have anything.
I love it. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah, a friend of mine posted his run on Strava. He did a 5-mile run at about like a 7:20 pace, and okay. Or 7:10. And I'm looking at that, and I'm training for my first ultra, so my pace is generally like 10, 11, you know. And I looked at that, and I'm like, I want that. And like the little kid in me was like, you know, I want it now. And then as I reflected, I was like, boy, I'm really looking forward to the pain. That, you know, the cost of get, because I can do 5 miles in seven-minute miles. Like, I know I can do it physically. I just know it's going to cost me a lot. And I was kind of excited about paying it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I can very much empathize with you. There's that just almost like masochistic element of running, right? But it's there and it's real.
Yeah, well, you know, I learned a phrase from Dan Ariely, who's a behavioral economist at Duke.
Yeah, of course.
He talks about benign masochism. And, you know, his team has done some studies of like CrossFit people and cyclists. And it's really interesting. You brought up behavioral economics. Like one of the books that I really like is called The Power of 50 Bits by Bob Neese. Who's like a?
Okay, I'm actually not familiar with that. Yeah.
Oh, he's not a researcher, but he knows all the research and he applies it at a big company that he either founded or has a big hand in. And one of the things he talks about a lot is like the mathematics of procrastination, which is like whatever we want, whatever we think about the future, we discount by like 50%. So like our future goals or the future pain of exercising is going to be down by 50%. Whereas like right now, if I think about like having an ice cream right now, that's like 100%. So my short-term desires are almost always twice as loud as my long-term desires. And it's like the idea of this benign masochism means that I take the long-term pain, and I actually convert it to this concept of short-term gain.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, you know, it's a kind of a mind hack that I think athletes kind of instinctively do.
I think that they have to, right? And I think, again, this is kind of my beat and where my mind always goes, but I'd argue that extends beyond sport as well. Whereas if you're constantly trying to suppress or resist the pain, you're not going to last. And let's not just say pain because that's very, very physical, but discomfort. So if you're avoiding this uncomfortable situations, or if when you get in uncomfortable situations, it's kind of like you're grinding your teeth together and you're waiting for it to be over. A, that's just not very pleasant. And then B, you're going to avoid those situations, or if those situations come up frequently, you probably won't last in what you're doing, or if you do last, you're not going to be very happy about it.
Yeah.
So it gets back to your switch. I think that there's so much power in accepting it and saying, okay, this hurts, but it's supposed to hurt because I'm pushing my body. Or this is really uncomfortable, but it's supposed to be uncomfortable because I'm in the middle of a huge corporate merger. And it's being able to accept that and realize. And it's not just me giving self-help. There's tons of science. I'd be glad to send you the links after for listeners. There's tons of science that says that growth happens when we put ourselves in those uncomfortable situations.
Yeah. When I was doing the corporate consulting stuff, we had a phrase, AFGO, A-F-G-O, which stood for another growth opportunity.
Yep. I don't have it in front of me, but Nick Lamb, you mentioned him earlier. One of the great performers that I've interviewed. He's a world champion big wave surfer. He spoke a lot just about the work that he's done with a sports psychologist on getting comfortable with fear and being able to embrace fear and growing from it. I think, you know, I'm pulling it up right now. He told me that it's only when you step outside your comfort zone that you grow. Being uncomfortable is the path of personal development. It is the opposite of complacency. I feel fear all the time. I never try to ignore it. Instead, I use the heightened sensation to my advantage. And this is coming from someone that rides 3 to 5 story waves. So it's neat, right? And this has been a huge learning experience for me. For a while, I thought that a lot of these adventure athletes, like, they didn't feel fear. And it's completely the opposite. They feel fear all the time. They feel discomfort. They've just figured out how to do that mindset switch that you talked about and embrace it, not try to suppress it, and even channel it and use it.
Yeah, I guess the big wave surfers who don't feel fear are not alive for you to interview.
Yeah, that could also be the case.
It's weird though, because you know you're kind of telling this story that is like, it's not just about like how an average person would become an athlete, but how an average person can become like an excellent human being, which you would think like we all would want to be. Like, this has like universal appeal. And yet when you look at like our society, like this is a really hard message to get across in terms of like marketing, you know, that like the way to get what you want is to, you know, be uncomfortable and suffer a little.
Yeah, it is. It is. I think that societally, right, comfort king. I can't close my family. My parents have an SUV, and even if I wanted to, I couldn't close the trunk using my own hands. I can only press a button. So if that's the point that we've gotten to, where things are so rigged to make us comfortable, you know, it's kind of a message that you have to swim upstream, and there aren't that many, like, you have to create your own opportunities to do it, to an extent.
Right, which I guess...
But it's the same society that you said also will tell you that you should grind the midnight oil and that you shouldn't sleep and that you should work, which is... to me, equally as problematic.
Huh. Yeah, that seems pretty schizo.
Yeah, it is.
And I guess the split is like you're not supposed to be self-aware while you're doing it. You're not doing it for the thing. You're doing it for the salary and the bonus and the retirement, right? So we live in a society of delayed gratification, in which everybody is addicted to instant gratification.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very wise.
that's weird to think about.
And I think the ideal thing is that you find something that you're doing that both leads to long-term growth and fulfillment and that you enjoy in the here and now. I mean, that's a big part of the reason why I've shifted from consulting to writing. Simply because, and I'm forfeiting tons of dollars to do it, but I like writing more. I enjoy it more. It fulfills me more, for a whole manner of reasons. It could be a whole other conversation. But at the same time, it's not to say that writing is easy. Writing's very, very hard for me. And there are days where I wish it would just be over and it's not. But I do my best to practice what I preach.
Yeah. I mean, for me, writing is like, you know, depending on the day, a daily 10K or a marathon. Like there's a part where I just have to force myself to sit and not do everything else that just seems so much more important.
Yeah. I mean, running and writing, there are so many parallels between the two. It gets back to that stress plus rest equals growth, that kind of cycle that I that I alluded to, I approach my writing in the same way. So much like you just said, there are days where I really don't want to write, but you just have to sit down, show up, and do the work, much like writing. But there are also times when I can get like in a real groove, and it takes a lot of courage for me to step away and be like, you know what, I've written like 2,000 words today. If I push any harder, I'm going to completely drain myself. I'm going to step away and turn it off. And I struggle mightily to turn it off. You know, with both running and writing, actually. Like, my biggest weakness as an athlete, and probably my biggest weakness as a writer, and you could even say a person, is the inability to turn it off. So as an athlete, that means I'm injury prone because I often push too hard. I don't always have the courage to rest appropriately. And as a writer, it's really hard at the end of the day to just be able to say I'm done for the day and turn it off.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see. Yeah. And then like, what if it never comes back? Right.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I do. Howard, I don't know about you, but I sleep with a little notebook next to my bed on my nightstand. Cause I'll often wake up in the middle of the night and like have worked something out on paragraph 5 of page 34 that I couldn't figure out. So I make sure that I can write that down.
Uh-huh. Yeah, when I wish I was that disciplined. I just have like backs of envelopes and stuff. then I look at it and it's like, you know, terrible handwriting, and I have no idea what I was thinking. But
yeah, but you can't have your phone in your bedroom, right? Because there's all kinds of sciences, so that's a no-no. So you're in between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, well, it's the phone is tough. You know, sometimes it'll go on airplane mode. Sometimes it'll just be like, you know, 4 feet away on the floor. I've tried the orange safety glasses for versus the blue screens. But yeah, I mean, back to this where we started talking about, like, you know, this article that caught my eye was like basically like the neuroscience and the physiology of running and exercise. It's like there's something really, really natural about human beings with our two legs running. And there's something really unnatural about a lot of our lives, like the fact that I'm sitting in a chair right now, or I don't need to like expend calories to go find calories. You know, like the phones in our bedroom are just one more example of how hard it is to live like a natural, you know, Homo sapiens.
Yeah, very much. You're not going to get an argument from me out of that. I think the message that I am trying to send through my writing and what I continue to learn is that the best way to function in this society that we haven't necessarily evolved, we haven't caught up with yet, is to make sure that we're protecting time to get back to our roots and engage in some of those more natural activities, because paradoxically doing those more natural activities will make us better able to perform in what we might call a more unnatural society. And I don't necessarily think it's unnatural. It's just the pace of technological change around us is moved much faster than our ability to adapt to it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like that you're not making a distinction, but there is, you know, there are sort of physiological imperatives that we have, you know, that maybe in another million years we would adapt to iPhones and SUV doors. Like, well, you know, we, you know, I don't know, lose opposable thumbs or something. But
it's hard. It's hard for me to be values neutral because, like, I'm a fitness nerd. I'm into health. Again, I don't always practice what I preach, but I certainly preach it a lot. So I'm a lot like you. Like, part of me is like, man, I hope that doesn't happen. But evolution just happens. It's really hard to control. But yeah, I think in this day and age, the pace of the things around us is, like, I'm going to repeat myself, has exceeded our ability to adapt to it. And it's really important to make sure that we protect time to engage in things that are more natural.
Yeah. So I want to come back to your recent piece on the Zen of running. So, you know, I do my running, you know, so I'm sort of the loneliness of the long distance runner. I run, you know, the rural routes around my house. But when I see, like, the most people I see running are running on treadmills at the gym with headphones in, and they're watching their personal screens. Like, how zen is that? Is that fine, or do you find that a little problematic?
So I have to be careful here. I try not to be too self-righteous. So I think that all movement is good, and all fitness and running is better than no fitness and running. So if the only way that you're going to get yourself to the gym to be able to run or hop on the elliptical or the stair climb or whatever it is to have your phone playing music while watching a movie on your iPad, not how I go about it, but you know, if that's what it takes to get you to the gym, and as a result, you're going to exercise for 45 minutes to an hour every day, that's great. Go for it. I'm fully supportive of it.
Uh-huh.
I think that you still get a lot of physical benefits from it, and you might even get some of the psychological benefits. You're doing something that's uncomfortable. Your body might be saying, no, go back to sleep, but you're forcing it to go to the gym. I think that that's wonderful. That's great. What I have realized is I get a lot more out of running than the physical and even the psychological by turning it all off. And like you, heading out to the trails, running on rural roads, not listening to music, and really just using running as almost like a moving meditation. That works for me. But it's not like I first came into running. You know, at first I listened to music, and sometimes I still do. So I try not to be too judgmental, but I will say that this, you know, the article Zen and the Art of Running talks a lot about the kind of quality that's created when you get so involved in the act of running that it's kind of like you become one with the run, and it gets you a lot more in tune with how your body works and how your body responds to different things. That cannot happen if you've got 9 other things going on while you're running.
Right. And I wasn't thinking in terms of necessarily, you know, passing judgment, but just like if you're putting on miles, every step you're either like function, you know, it's like a car with the, you know, the axle slightly out. You know, if you don't notice that, it's going to eventually lead to a breakdown. And
yep.
Like running is such, as you said, you know, just your body, maybe a pair of sneakers and the road, and every single step is giving you feedback. And
yeah.
Just in terms of form and health and sustainability. Like, I think
it's a wonderful place to practice self-awareness.
Yeah. So maybe even if you just say, like, you know, I'm just going to do it for 2 minutes at the beginning or the end.
I think that's really good advice. And there's something to say, again, now I'm just speaking personally. So I wouldn't say like I practice one form of running. Sometimes I enjoy a group run with friends and we're chatting the whole time. Those are great. They're uplifting. They're wonderful. I look forward to them. I don't often run with music, but when I do, I like it. It's kind of like a treat. And then when I go out and I run without music, I really also just like letting my mind wander. So not being aware of anything and just whatever pops in, kind of playing with it. And then when it goes, it goes.
Mm.
I find that I can have often, like, I'll think of, oh, I want to write a story about this topic. And just it popped into my head out of nowhere. And then there are other runs where I'm very deliberate about, I really want to focus and pay attention on what's going on in my body and what it feels like as I hit the ground and as I push off the ground. You know, the most I can probably do that is probably 10 minutes. And then I kind of, nope, my brain just shifts elsewhere and that's fine.
Yeah. So I have a question for you, because this is actually something that I struggle with. So I'm out on a run and suddenly I get like an idea for a podcast or something I want to send out to clients or students, and I'm sure I'm going to forget it. Like, do you have any sort of idea capture technology with you on your runs?
No, I'm pretty sure that my 30 best ideas for stories are lost because that happened. I could be such a more profound writer if I had that technology. No, I'm with you. And then, you know, we're nerding out on running here and writing, but then what happens with me is I don't enjoy the run because I'm trying so hard not to forget the idea.
Yeah.
And that's no way to do a trail run, is to just be like repeating some idea in your head. And then what can really be killer is you get home and you shower and you write it down and you realize that wasn't that good of an idea after all. Like, it wasn't such a great idea to begin with.
Oh, my problem is I write it down, or I just repeat these three or four words, and then I get home and I'm like, I don't really know what I was thinking. Like, it was a great idea, but these words don't tell me what it was anymore.
Yeah, no, I share your pain. I wish I had a solution. I do not.
Well, I mean, I have a solution. It doesn't, I don't know that it's worth it, but like, you know, I'll have the iPhone on, you know, around my waist in a waist pack. And then I just have like a one button to some recorder. And then I try not to like slow down too much or stop, but you know, so, like, I'll listen to it later and I'm just like panting and wheezing and cars are going by and honking. And, so that's my current solution.
Yeah, it's tough. I don't love running with the phone. Even if I like were to turn it on airplane mode, it's just like it bobs up and down.
Yeah.
But on my long runs, I'll run with my, because I like you, sometimes I'll do pretty long trail runs and it's just a matter of safety. I haven't had to call my wife and be like, I'm totally out of gas, come get me. But I'll run with the phone on some of my longer trail runs. And yeah, you know, maybe once or twice I've pulled up like the note function and jotted down an idea, but generally I probably just lose those ideas.
Right. Or maybe we could just have faith that the ideas, the good ones, will come back.
Right. Yeah.
The courage to run without working.
Exactly.
That's great. So just getting back to how exercise shapes you, just maybe it's just a few more of the things that you discovered when you started researching, like all these other ways in which exercise is helpful to us as human beings.
Yeah. So there's the whole physiological suite of things, right? So it's good for your weight. It's good for your bones. It's good for your blood sugar. It's good for your heart. Although there are some myths around arthritis, there's a fair amount of research that shows that if you are thoughtful in how you approach running, again, and you kind of adhere to that, yes, stress yourself, but make sure you recover. Running actually can strengthen your joints, and runners don't have cartilage problems. So it's a very long-winded way of saying that running is very good for you physiologically. Some of the more recent research that I think is fascinating is around the psychological benefits of running. So there are more and more studies. They all have small sample sizes, so it's hard to say like this is a conclusive finding, but the evidence has led me to believe that running or engaging in any kind of hard physical activity can help increase one's willpower. So I guess the theory would go that if you have a physical practice that you push yourself relatively hard in, you might be better able to resist saying something to a colleague that after you say it, you wish you wouldn't have said, or to make healthy food choices, or I should say to resist junk food. And the theory there goes is that when you're exercising, you're basically training your willpower. So on that 5-mile run that you want to do at 7:10 pace, like you said, it's going to hurt. And even if you're very zen about accepting the pain and playing with it and trying to enjoy it, odds are there will be a time in that run where you have to make a decision. And that decision is, do I slow down or do I continue to push? And in that instant, you're training your willpower, right? You're making a hard choice. And oftentimes it's a hard choice. I want to tell my colleague that he or she is just so dumb, but you pause and you're like, do I really need to do that? No, you make the hard choice. You keep on going. Right. Or, you know, the Cheetos are in front of me. They're right there at my friends. And I want to grab a handful. And again, it's a hard choice not to, but you're making that hard choice. So to me, that's a very, it's intuitive. It makes a lot of sense. And like I said, there's enough science there where I believe that is an effective exercise.
Yeah. And I found for myself and for some of my clients that actually pushing through the run or whatever is much easier than resisting the impulse, because I know the run is going to be over But the impulse is like, you know, when have I won? How, you know, I've resisted the Cheetos for a minute, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Like, you know, there's no finish line. But with an activity, it's like, okay, if I just do this for 10 more minutes. So it feels much more doable, even though it may be objectively much harder.
Yeah, I think that that's probably true. And it's not that because you run, you're going to be, you know, have steadfast willpower and you'll always resist the Cheetos. What the science just shows is it makes you more likely to be able to pause and resist the Cheetos. I mean, I'm much better like you at pushing through a run than I am at resisting the Cheetos. But I think I'd probably be worse at resisting the Cheetos if I didn't run to begin with. And again, I know we're talking about running because we're both runners, but I want to be clear for listeners. You could get this benefit by doing the elliptical trainer, by doing the stair climber, by lifting weights. The mechanism doesn't much matter, nor does the intensity. You don't have to be an ultra runner like Howard to do this. You could go out for a 2 mile run. As long as it's hard for you and you're doing something that's hard for you, and in the moment you're making a choice to continue to do it, that tends to have all sorts of spillover benefits.
Yeah, and certainly my definition of what intensity looks like has changed a lot in the 3 months that I've been training. You know, so if I was still doing the runs I was doing in May, like I don't think I'd be getting much benefit.
Sure, because if you've trained, you've increased your fitness and your tolerance to run harder, longer, faster.
Yeah. Yeah. So another question for you before we wrap up is, like, how do you do research? How do you decide, like, you know, where you look, what, how you evaluate studies? Like, how do you go about, you have a hunch, how do you go about using research sort of respectfully and as, you know, as you had a non-siloed approach to confirm or deny or shape your conclusions, as opposed to like, hey, I have this idea, let me just go out and find stuff that proves it.
Yeah, that's a really good question. My initial process is I have an idea, I have a hunch, because I've read, you know, this psychology book or this behavioral economics book, and I know this theory from physiology, and they seem pretty well related. So the first thing I'll do is I'll look and I'll see, is there a study that actually looks at whatever my hunch is? So has someone actually done a randomized control trial in a scientific setting and published it in a peer-reviewed journal? Oftentimes that's not the case, especially, like I said, when I'm looking across domains that hasn't happened. So the second thing that I'll do is, rather than just come up with a narrative that makes sense to me and might make sense to others, I'll get on the phone. I mean, ideally I do this in person, but oftentimes there's geographical barriers. So I'll get on the phone or Skype. I don't like to email, but sometimes you email with the researchers that are experts in their silo field. And I'll say, hey, I have this idea. Can you give me your thoughts on it? Mm-hmm. And more often than not, for every article I publish, there are two that I don't, because their thoughts are, doesn't really make sense, or the mechanism's different, and here's why. But when as a writer, and it gets kind of back to one of my many purposes, which is to help inspire people, but to do so, you know, it's kind of like, what I don't want to be is a person that is seen as kind of wishy-washy, preachy self-help that's not based in evidence. I want to inspire people and help people, but I want to do it in a way that's based in evidence, because that will have the best chance of it working. So it's hard, right? You think you have a great idea, you think it works, it's hard to kill that idea. But for me, I kind of come back to that purpose, and I'm like, well, you know, if this isn't actually going to work or help people, I don't want to put that out there.
Right.
But there's a lot of crap out there.
Oh my God. I was going to ask you about that. You know, at the end of your article, you cite this, like, you know, don't run a marathon sort of as exhibit A. It must make you cringe to see so many of your colleagues just sort of running with half-baked or unsupported concepts.
Yeah, it does. It does. It gets back to a theme that we were speaking about earlier, right? Like, the message is often in any discipline, in this kind of like the literature on human performance, let's call it, in all the domains, all the academic fields that feed into that. Generally, it's, you have to put in the work. It's not going to be easy. You might be uncomfortable. Here are some good ways that you can put in the work, and here are some kind of tips that might help you put in the work and help you get the most out of the work. But very rarely does someone publish a top 7 hacks to, you know, improve your cognitive ability. And I've yet to find the magical supplement that will make me a superhuman athlete or a superhuman thinker. it's just not out there. So I'm not, you know, I'm not selling something that's nearly as sexy as that. But what I am selling and what I hold myself to is ideas and practices that are backed in evidence. And it's not to say that science doesn't change. Often science changes as well, but I'm of the belief that generally, I mean, the best that we have to go on is science. So that's what I try to go on.
Yeah. Also, like in, you know, I write a lot about food and nutrition, and yep. One of the things that, you know, professional writers, journalists, and scientists complain to me about is that the stuff they're writing is boring because everybody already knows it, so it's not getting published. Like, no one wants to read another frigging article about kale.
Yeah.
Like, do you ever have that in terms of like the economics of your profession? Is you say, you know, I have an article on like why we have to work hard in order to achieve our goals, and they're like, no, you know, we need something sexy.
Yeah, I think, you know, I try to use that as fuel, because to me it means, all right, I need to write, like, my writing needs to be good, and I need to spend a lot of time telling this in a compelling way, because, like you said, like, it's not too sexy, so the writing itself better be sexy.
Huh.
The other thing, again, because my beat is kind of, like, pulling from different domains and connecting things that might not have been connected before, so that can often bring some newness to it. So I think if I was just writing about behavioral economics for behavioral economists, the well would dry up rather fast. But because I'm taking things from behavioral economics and applying them to fitness, it's new and fresh. And because I'm taking things from fitness and physiology and applying them to, you know, human psychology and cognitive performance, it can be fresh there. If you talk to me in 2 years, I might be like, oh my God, Howard, like my well is dry. What should I do? and that's when we can publish our nine hacks to this, that, or the other.
that's great. I love, you know, you help me think about my own writing in a different way. Like there's days in which I go, you know, why am I pushing this message of like, eat your fruits and vegetables when the people, you know, it's so trite and boring, and like, what else can I say about it? Well, you know, the challenge there is the same as the challenge in running a race, like create a new personal record, like do something better than you've ever done it or better than anyone's ever done it. I love that. I think you just helped me write my next 10 articles better. Thank you.
Good. I'm glad that I could help. Now, but again, coming full circle, it's not easy, right? Like I throw away all kinds of stuff. Because it's hard. It's a challenge.
Yeah. I'd like to say I throw away stuff, but I'm like, well, that's what my blog's for.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, tell us a little bit more about the book and when it might come out and how folks can stay in touch and follow your excellent writing.
So thank you. The book is called Peak Performance. Coming out in June of 2017. I think June 6th is the tentative sale date. And then in terms of staying in touch and following my writing, I'm fairly active on Twitter, where my handle is @bstahlberg, just like my name. And then my website is also my name, so www.bradstahlberg.com. There's a contact form on there, and something that I just love is when folks reach out with questions, with compliments, and also, you know, disagreements as well, because it helps me think about things in a different way and really forces me to make sure I'm being bulletproof on the work that I'm trying to do.
Awesome. All right. I'll put all those links in the show notes, and hope folks will follow you, because You know, you're every time you write something now, I learn something, I get a little nuance, and most importantly, I come away with a nugget that I know I'm going to use to help somebody. So I really appreciate the work you're doing, and I'm personally selfishly glad you left the world of consulting to do what you're doing now.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to hear that from you. And I've really enjoyed this hour, and hopefully listeners like it. But I've got a lot to think about just coming out of this conversation. So thank you, too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much, Brad.
Bye.
Take care. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Plant Yourself podcast. Be sure to check out the show notes with links to Brad's article and everything else we talked about at plantyourself.com/180. And if you want to get healthy and fit, even if you've tried before and failed, though especially if you've tried before and failed, check out bigchangeprogram.com. The new description isn't up yet, but we are about to start in November 2016 our final run of the Big Change Program for 2016. And so we'll be opening it up next week, but check it out now, start thinking about it. And if you have any questions, let me know, hj@plantyourself.com. Okay, if you're new to this podcast, you can catch up on 179 archived episodes. That should be here for a while, over at plantyourself.com. And if you get the podcast, but not the weekly email newsletter, why don't you get over to plantyourself.com and sign up for that as well. Thanks to Plant Yourself Podcast patrons Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Anthony Disson, Brittany Porter, Dominic Merrill, Elizabeth Clifton, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Christine Nielsen, Tina Sharp, Tina Ahearns, Jan Tolkanovsky, David Vizek, The Mysterious Michelle X, Elton Feldman, Victoria Dolomanova, Delia Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Holt, Josina, Julianne Rowland. Woo! For your generous support of the podcast. If you would like to support this show, you can share this and other episodes on social media, via email, tell your friends. You can write a review on iTunes. Oh, that helps so much. It really does. And you can become a patron by pledging a one-time amount or an ongoing gift to the podcast over at plantyourself.com. So I just had a meeting with a guy, a local guy, who's going to help me build a little outbuilding office. So it's going to be my own little space. I won't have to be quiet and sneak around the house. And I'm thinking about putting in an audio rack for some better equipment. So if you want to be part of that, it's a good time to pledge. And you can do that at plantyourself.com over on the right side where it says donate or Patreon. In garden news, it's real exciting to see all of the greens we planted last month now coming up and looking like food, from the mizuna to the mustard greens to a beautiful patch of bok choy. So we're getting to the point where I can stop buying greens from the supermarket and now just go out to my own backyard and pick them. Boy, is that an exciting feeling to know that I know everything about this plant from the time it was a teeny-weeny little seed. Last weekend, I was at the Raleigh, North Carolina Veg Fest, where I met some people who are going to be podcast guests in the future. Laura Theodore, the jazzy vegetarian, has agreed to come onto my podcast, and we're going to schedule that for next month. And also now it's going to be a second time appearance by Ellen Jaffe Jones, who is a plant-based coach and runner, championship runner. She has a new book called Vegan Fitness for Mortals that she was kind enough to give me and sign for me. And so, you know, now I'm all on this fitness kick and not just on the plant-based kick. So I appreciate her work even more now than I did the first time I interviewed her. Gosh, must have been 2 or 3 years ago. So that's all for this week. And as always, be well, my friends.